Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad you tuned in today. We've got an important conversation ahead. Well, you know, you hear it said often that there's no room in politics for the faith conversation. Have you heard that? Who is they anyway? And who actually gets to decide which questions we ask? And while we're asking questions, is it even possible to approach politics without religion or faith somehow influencing our decisions? If you were a leader, wouldn't your faith impact your religion? I mean, your choices, politically speaking? Well, my guest today says this is a conversation that we absolutely must have. It's important for us to know where our leaders stand on matters of faith, what they believe about the Bible. So honored to have Stephen Mansfield back on the program today. The title of his new book is this, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. This is a gutsy book. It's a historical book. It is full of amazing information. This is what Stephen writes. He says, what will be neither forgivable nor understandable is if our generation of Americans, with all of the evidence amassed before us, continues to allow religion in American politics to be sentimental, barely comprehensible, a shadowy thing it has been. Those in Munich who had heard Adolf Hitler speak eventually wished they'd asked more questions. We, too, must ask the questions of faith that need to be asked. It's time for the mysteries, the uncertainties, and the gambling with the nation's future to end. Please let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Stephen Mansfield is a New York Times bestselling author and a popular speaker who coaches leaders worldwide. His books include The Search for God in Guinness, The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama, and Killing Jesus. Stephen lives in Nashville and Washington, D.C. with his wife, Beverly, who's an award-winning songwriter and producer. You can find his influencer page on our website at myfaithradio.com. Dear Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. Great to be back again.
We joked before the show that I said you're putting out these amazing books like a Pez dispenser, and you said like a 10-foot Pez dispenser. People don't know that you're
900 pounds. Yeah. I don't think I suggest that image to people who see me, but anyway.
Well, just for our listeners' sake, he's a giant of a man, physically and spiritually, and I mean in height and stature, right? So, well, you know the drill. We love to start out talking scripture, and you chose Colossians 1, verses 16 and 17. I'll read it, and I'd just love for you to speak to this passage. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Powerful passage. Talk about that.
Well, that passage moves me, and I thought it was particularly relevant to what we're talking about today, because all of us know what it's like to watch the news programs and just go away feeling like the world is spinning out of control. But for us who believe in Jesus, believe in his lordship in the world, we have to remember that all things are created for him and by him. And in that passage, specifically, thrones and powers are discussed. So, you know, whatever Donald Trump is or isn't doing, whatever Hillary Clinton is or isn't doing, whatever the Pope is saying or whatever's happening in the world, whatever disturbing things are taking place, we believe in a king who rules over the affairs of the earth. And if we put all the scriptures together, we find that God does as he wills with the peoples of the earth, that he rules the nations. He sets one up, puts another down. I'm not saying that elections and political issues aren't important, but let's always keep a firm grasp on the lordship of Jesus.
Amen. Well put, Stephen. So you explored the faith of George W. Bush. You explored the faith of Barack Obama, and you paid a price for it in some ways. I mean, you got threatened, and people critiqued you, sometimes very unfairly. And so you've really tackled subjects that really have stirred up all kinds of opinions. So you go to this book, ask the question. You don't shy away. This is what I'm saying is, you know, why we must demand religious clarity from our presidential candidates. How was this book, Stephen, first born in your heart?
Well, as you say, I've been writing about this subject, studying it for quite some time, and I finally decided to write a book that would maybe be the broad case that I was making. I wrote about specific people, but I think that some folks enjoyed the story of the faith of Bush or the faith of Lincoln, maybe the faith of Barack Obama, but they weren't getting the broader case, which is, look, religion is influencing our candidates, our elections, our national life. We are not a secular nation, but we are a religiously diverse nation. So we've got to understand some things that maybe we don't understand. And I have fun in the book by going to some of the surveys that have been done about the religious knowledge, Bible knowledge of people in America. Well, it can be absolutely hilarious. The title of that chapter, by the way, is one of those answers. Noah's wife was Joan of Arc. And I'm having fun, of course, but yeah. My point is, we live in a very religiously diverse time. Mm. We live at a time when the words don't tend to mean what they used to mean. I mean, mm-hmm. what does the word Catholic really mean today? There's Joe Biden Catholic and Mark Rubio Catholic. And what does Methodist mean? Well, there are many different types of Methodists. So all that to say that I decided to really just put the case right out there and to do it during this election. And, man, the timing couldn't have been better because wow. We've got a real religious fight going on here. So mm-hmm. that's where the book came from.
Well, I appreciate that so much. Well, you open the book by describing a 2015 White House Correspondents Association dinner. Tell us about that night, Stephen, and what was unusual about it.
Well, I live half my year in D.C., so I'm very familiar with the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and it's a big affair, and it's kind of been taken over by the big media outlets of Sony and others. Very glitzy, very ritzy, always highlighted. But in this last one and in some others, there were no religion reporters at all invited. No one who specializes in writing about the connection between religion and politics. Well, I use this to set up a trend that's happening in our society, that while religion is increasingly important to understand what's happening in our world and specifically our politics, there's less knowledge of it in American society. And part of the reason for that is that you have fewer and fewer people writing about it, making the connections, educating the American people. And then, of course, we know that our schools don't tend to emphasize that or make it part of their assignment. So we've got a great gap happening, and I thought I'd use that event, that big glitzy event in D.C., to make the point.
Mm, so good. Here's a quote from the opening pages. The state of the union of religion and politics in America is clear. Religion is thriving. The nation's politics are as faith-based as ever. Yet, reporting on religion is near an all-time low, and there's much the voters still need to know. Okay, talk about that gap and why it's there.
Well, the fact is that we have allowed our candidates to get away with, you know, pious mush, the castaway, cast-off sentence, God bless America at the end of a speech, maybe video of them carrying a Bible into church, and that's all fine. At least we're still at that level. At least there's some discussion of faith. But we rarely get around to asking the specific question, what do you mean by that? What's that going to mean when you get into office? I don't want to see religion for any candidate become an unelected co-president when they get in office. I believe we should be asking the questions. And we've had some real important moments in the recent presidencies. Barack Obama completely reversed himself about same-sex marriage and said he did so based on his faith, his reading of the Sermon on the Mount. Other presidents have done much the same thing. We have some candidates for president this time who have had huge reversals on issues that they used to contend for and attributed the change to their faith. So I'm not saying changes aren't going to be possible, but we need to be processing these things in the campaigns and asking the tough questions that get beyond just the, again, not to be too negative, but the pious mush that tends mm-hmm. to fill most campaigns.
Well, you said something would be easy to miss, that you don't want an unelected co-president to be governing this nation. In other words, that whatever their religion is, it is going to impact their politics. Whether we say we should keep them separate, it's not really possible, is it?
No, it's really not. And we just need to get comfortable with that idea. To put it humorously, it's as though I ran for president and I said, look, there's a guy over here in the wings. His name is Bob. And Bob's going to influence everything that I do in office. But I'm not really going to tell you much about Bob. I'll tell you about him once I get into office. Then I'll introduce him to you. Just vote for me anyway. Well, I wouldn't get one vote. Nobody would send me to the White House based on that silliness. But that's exactly what we do with religion. We don't really understand what a candidate's religion is, even when they tell us that their religion will influence them while while they're in office. And so we should be investigating this, by the way, as the founding fathers expected that we would, long before we put them in office.
So tell me this. Do we shy away from these pointed questions because of the intrusive nature of most media outlets? Like, we don't want to be like them? Or are we really just relegating them, leaving the questions up to the media and just taking the answers too lightly?
Well, this is one of the reasons I've addressed the book more to the American people, because the media tends to treat a candidate's religion like an oddity, like some kind of weirdness about them, you know, like they like peanut butter and cereal or something, some weird thing about them. But I think the American people are starting to realize, well, that's not enough. We need to have a broader understanding. So, yeah, the press has sort of failed us, except for those who specialize in this and have done a great job, because they don't really air out the depth of meaning and the implications of a candidate's religion for their politics. They tend to treat it as though, as one person said, as though religion is a wart on a candidate's nose, something not to be talked about for polite reasons, but certainly to be gossiped about, you know, that kind of a thing. And I think that we need to go further.
Do you think that some would consider faith a private affair? And if they do, I would love for you to speak to that person listening today, but I can't help but go back to your Bob analogy. If we keep it a private affair, then Bob just waltzes right into that White House with you, and he whispers in your ear every single day with all these important choices you need, decisions you need to make. What say you?
Sure. I mean, I want to say very clearly, I believe we should treat all questions about religion with respect, mm-hmm. not be angry, not be bombarding a candidate. I don't want to invade a candidate's prayer life. I don't want to try to make them into a theologian. They're not. And by the way, if a candidate says, look, I have zero religion, I mean, Bernie Sanders is pretty close to that. I have zero religion. I'm not influenced by religion. I'm not faith-based at all. Okay, I'm willing to leave them alone on that basis. But every other candidate in this particular presidential election, for example, is in some way faith-based and says, my faith will influence what I do in office. Well, we're back to the Bob analogy, aren't we? If you tell me that you're faith-based and that your politics grow organically from your faith and that it will influence you when you're in office, well, I am irresponsible as an American citizen if I don't try to understand what that faith is and sort of connect the dots between faith and particular policy positions. And so that's what I'm talking about. Only if a candidate says my faith will be of influence do I want to press in. And I think that's just fair. It's not a counterattack. It's simply saying, you say this is of influence, I want to understand it. Please answer these questions.
Why don't we have the confidence to do that, Stephen? What are we afraid of?
Well, I think it's a number of things that come to bear on us. You know, my Southern grandmother used to say, don't talk about religion and politics in polite company. And so I learned that early on. And then I think we have sort of a visceral response that comes from the First Amendment. Hey, if the church and state are to be separate, maybe personal faith and governing are meant to be separate too. So we do it for that reason. And then there's just sort of a feeling, even members of the press have it, that, hey, this is private. We shouldn't talk about it. And again, I'm not trying to invade their bedroom or their prayer life or get into their checking account. They said something was going to shape how they were going to lead the country. I should understand that. It's funny. We live in an era where we sometimes know a president's underwear style, what his dog's name is, sometimes sexual details we wish we didn't know, and we can't ask about their religion, which is going to shape what they do in the Oval Office. It feels to me like a little bit of cultural hypocrisy, and I'd like for us to politely step beyond it.
And that's the title of the book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. Unbelievable, really beautiful hardcover book published by Baker. We've got two copies of this great, great book. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Not taking any calls today. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put Ask the Question in the subject line. Give me your mailing address, and a couple of you win a copy of this. And I think this, you're going to get some history lesson here. You're going to be equipped, I think, to ask the hard questions. When we come back, I'm going to ask Stephen the consequence. What's been the consequence of our lack of engagement, of sort of leaving these questions even unasked by the media? What's the ripple effect? We'll talk more about that when we return. Having a great day today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Stephen Mansfield. I always love when he joins us on the show. His books have so much substance. We're celebrating the brand new release of his book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. I read this excerpt at the first segment, at the open of the show. I want to read it again. I want you to hear this, all right? The state of the union of religion and politics in America is clear. Religion is thriving. The nation's politics are as faith-based as ever. Yet, reporting on religion is near an all-time low, and there's much the voters still need to know. If we're leaving our questions to the media to ask these clarifying questions about our candidates' faith, we're going to be left without answers that we desperately need. And I'm wondering if you can paint a picture, Stephen, of the ripple effect or the consequence thus far of our maybe lack of engagement through the years of not asking these clarifying questions.
Well, we've had major policy reversals by presidents. We've had people in high office who simply make their faith very unclear, I think, during the campaigns, and then suddenly the lines firm up, and they're very influenced by their faith once they get in office. And I'll tell you another thing that I think is important, just make sure I throw this in. It's not just what a candidate believes. We also ought to just check a little bit on what a candidate knows. We found out when our military went into Iraq, there was an episode that caused some journalists to start checking in D.C. Who among the higher ranks of our intelligence services and military really understood the difference, for example, between Sunni and Shiite, two subsects within Islam, and something that you really need to know if you're going into Iraq? Well, it turned out that many of them had no idea. So I don't want to give out an intelligence test or a test on world religions as part of the campaign, but I do think we ought to pay attention to who really does understand the religions that are shaping our world, and are they ready to contend with them? And we've seen, I think, a lot of both damage from the reversals and also damage from the lack of knowledge in a number of the recent presidential administrations.
Can you give some suggested questions we could ask for clarity's sake?
When I'm helping people understand how to ask the question, there's one approach that I take. I call it the draw a line question, and it's very simple, and it's respectful. If you, Susie, are running for office and you say, well, I'm faith-based, and I'm very faith-based on immigration, and that's usually where it stops in a campaign, I would say, ma'am, would you please draw a line between your position on immigration and any scripture, theological belief, tenet of your faith, teaching of your church that shapes your policies? I'm always asking, draw a line, connect for me your politics with your religion, if in fact you have said you are a faith-based politician. And I think that's a fair question. It's a gentle question. It's a polite question. And I find when I have a chance to ask candidates that kind of approach, to use that structure, that I get really good answers.
Have you also found that, I would imagine because you're civil and you're well-read, people are pretty open to talking with you, but have you bumped into any politicians who've been hesitant to talk about their faith, where they've pushed back and said, now you're kind of treading on some private territory here?
I have. And I will tell you what was interesting. I've had two or three occasions like that. And when I said, now, sir, now, ma'am, I'm not trying to be intrusive. You said that you're faith-based. You said that you would take your faith into the Oval Office and it would be of influence. I'm asking you, both as a writer and as a citizen, exactly what that influence is going to be. And they would catch the fact. They would perhaps even, I don't know, I don't think it was for the first time, but they would see, hey, I'm not trying to be, you know, People Magazine here and invade your private space. I'm asking you public policy questions that are legitimate for me to ask. And they began to open up. So many of them have just been attacked for their religion, not genuinely questioned about their religion. And I think they're open to the polite questioning that leads to understanding.
Stephen, how often do we leave these questions to other people? I mean, you think of the power of groupthink. It seems like it's picking up strength year after year, where I look for the bandwagon and I jump on it because I don't want to think for myself. And even in your chapter about Noah's wife is Joan of Arc, I mean, a lot of young people are getting their news from comedy, you know, shows. Talk about just the power of groupthink and the importance of just having the courage to step back and ask these thoughtful questions.
Yeah, I think you really do have to sort of jump off the bandwagon, as you say, and ask yourself, what do I really know? For example, and I'm not going after the left just for, you know, I'm just choosing anyone off the slate of candidates. Hillary Clinton says, I am a social gospel Methodist. Okay. Now, because I actually, you know, got a doctorate in the field and I study religions, I happen to know what that is. I'll be willing to bet you that less than 10% of Americans know what that is. But she says it all the time, and she genuinely believes it. It's not as though she's lying. This is who she is. Don't we want to know what that means? And I think that the millennials, the young voters in particular, in their kind of raw and hard-hitting way, they're really responding to what I've written and others have written about this kind of approach, that we need to understand religion. They aren't about the niceties as much, as we all know. They're pretty raw. They want to sort of storm in and understand and get things straight. It's why they tend to like Bernie Sanders, who feels all, you know, raw and hard-hitting. And so I think that we're going to see a change of culture, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to help turn the culture a bit on this very issue.
Well, we live in this, what, you know, so many call postmodern context, and so there are people who think religion is kind of sidelined to the point that it doesn't exactly exist, where you say America is still one of the most religious nations in the world, but the point is that the American religion is changing in its form. So truly, it's very active in informing people's decisions. It just looks different than it once did. Would you unpack
that?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, first of all, to the first point, you know, every time the press gets a chance, they're predicting the death of religion. You know, you start having a little less church attendance, and then there's the rise of the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, people who just can't click a certain category of religion on a form, and the press starts announcing the death of religion. The fact is that 90% of Americans believe in God. Just recently, the Pew Forum came out with a survey, survey results that said that the vast majority of Americans would not want an atheist president. They want their president to believe in God. And more than half said, we'd like to see more religious discussion of in the campaigns. So nothing's changing there. What's really interesting is that some of the trends, like the nuns, for example, you and I know the evangelical culture fairly well. If there are evangelicals who attend independent non-denominational churches that aren't wouldn't be listed on a form, they aren't Baptist, Methodist, Church of Christ, Catholic, what have you, well, then these are nuns. Even though they go to church very faithfully and are relatively traditional Christians. So some of these broad categories just don't work. The other aspect of this is that as we do in some cases become less traditional in our approach to religion, we have to ask the question all the more because the traditional words don't work. We're going to have people who run for office who say, I'm not of any religion, but they're very much like some of the soldiers that I questioned in Iraq when I was embedded with the troops. I asked one guy what he thought and what he believed. He said, well, two parts Sunday school, a little bit of Deepak Chopra, a couple of Budweiser commercials, and maybe some fortune cookies. That's literally what he was thinking. Now, he's just sort of doing the faith buffet. He's sort of curating a faith of his own. And that's what's happening, even if people wear labels. I mean, you have people who say, I'm Roman Catholic, and they believe all kinds of things that don't traditionally fit in the Roman Catholic category. So that's why we have to question the individual candidate, because the words alone don't tell us what they used to tell us.
Labels don't mean even what they used to mean. Why we need to ask top questions. When we come back, we're going to talk about Stephen's statement that we Americans are like a feuding family born of very different parents. Can't wait for you to hear what he has to say about that. Title of his book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. This is such a civil, thoughtful book. This is not a rant. This is so informative. Two copies. Give me an email, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Write Ask the Question. Include your mailing address. I hope you win a copy. It's a great book. More with Stephen Mansfield when we return. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. And if you listen often enough, you know this is a deeper life show. We just like to plumb the depths of the deeper things of walking with God, growing on to maturity. Don't often talk politics on this show, but if I'm going to, Stephen Mansfield's the guy I want to talk to. He's been on the show a good handful of times before. Title of his brand new book is Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. Excuse me, before the break, I mentioned we've got a couple copies of this amazing hardcover book, so full of great content. Love to get a copy in your hands. Email me in the subject line, put Ask the Question. Give me your mailing address. Two of you will win a copy. My email is Susie@myfaithradio.com. So, Stephen, you say that we as Americans are like a feuding family born of very different parents. Say more if you would.
Sure. We have a great many Americans who are people of faith, most of them Judeo-Christian in some form, and they want public expressions of faith. They understand our religious history as a nation. They understand the intentions of the original First Amendment, and they want to see faith expressed freely in the society and allow it to shape our politics. Then, of course, we have another side. You can call them secular or non-Christian in some way. And I'm not so much talking about people who might be Muslim or Jewish. I'm talking about those who are radically anti-religion. And this, of course, this view is expressed by, you know, People for the American Way or the ACLU, organizations like that. And there's a real contest going on in our society. Even small towns have to deal with whether they have the legal right to pray at football games or whether the football team, the coach can pray with his team. And we see these all the time. And our nation is really ripped up by that. Very great tension, even within families, even within schools, even within small rural school districts, and it's going to continue. And the fundamental issue is whether any expression of faith in our public life is legitimate. I say, of course, that it is. It's always been thus. It's a natural expression of what it means to engage in politics, and we need a resetting of the lines here that have been set by courts and are really causing problems in our society.
Indeed, and this may be just a side note, but I think as we steward, as Christ followers, as we steward the land beneath our feet, our vocation, our faith, we contribute to our family's life, you know, just of faith, to the point where you're basically fertilizing the grass under your feet and you are developing a healthy family and you're showing up on time for work and doing excellent work there. I just feel like you become a staying force in your community to the point where if someone who really rejects faith hits a crisis, oftentimes, you know, we're the ones that they come to talk to when they need a listening ear. I just think there's something to be said about faithfulness and stewardship in our current life calling, you know?
I think you're absolutely right. And I got to tell you, I do a lot of interviewing, a lot of speaking as you do, and a lot of open forums about religion. And I got to tell you that almost every employer I've ever spoken with found that the Christians in particular and people of faith in general were the better employees. And this is not bigotry on my part. This is borne out by many, many surveys that people who have values, that do their jobs to the glory of God, who come with a moral and ethical set that maybe isn't even discussed on the job, et cetera, people who are pro-family, people who don't give themselves to alcoholism, drunkenness, drug abuse, et cetera, all of these things make them better employees. And so even secular employers will say, oh, gosh, let me have as many, you know, Christians, as many people of faith as I can possibly have. They're awesome. So I think you're right. I think that is how we earn the right to be heard, confirm our gospel, and make a difference in society.
Mm. So as you said before the break, Stephen, that even because there's so many departures even in religion that we can't even accept the labels for what they used to be just because they mean something so different. So a politician can slap a label saying, I'm a Baptist, I'm a Catholic, you know, but we've got to be able to delve a little bit deeper. It's not even enough for politicians to simply appeal to American values, right? Because even those are vastly different depending on who you ask.
Well, there's again that mushy language, okay? Technically now, American values are in support of same-sex marriage, technically, because our Supreme Court has ruled. Now, I don't think that's organically coming from the people, but a politician can get up and say, I'm in favor of good American values. Well, he or she might be referring to something that's completely antithetical to our founding values and completely antithetical to the Judeo-Christian consensus in our society, which is, you know, occupies about 75% of the people in this country. And so that's why you'd have to say, whoa, 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 stop just a minute. What do you mean by American values? I have to say, and I say this kindly, that if Barack Obama was on this phone call, my version of American values and his would be different. Well, that's why asking the question is important. We can't just leave it at catchphrases and broad, airy language that hangs up there in the air but never gets specific.
Okay, Stephen, you and I have talked about this before. I'd love to have you give us some guardrails as far as how we discern the issues, ask thoughtful questions without overstepping on our assessments and no longer looking like Christ in the way that we press the issue, if you know what I mean. So
sure.
Give us a healthy balance of what that looks like.
Well, yes, I would say that, first of all, we have got to deal with the anger that many of us feel. I don't want to turn this to a therapy time, but part of what makes people like me, I'll say, Christians, person of faith, person active in politics and wanting to make a difference in our country, part of what makes us a bit of a byword is that we tend to be angry. You can see it. You can hear it on TV. And I understand righteous anger, but no one who is infused by anger is engaging on any subject. An angry preacher, an angry parent, an angry spouse, nobody wants to be around these kind of people. Second of all, we've got to make sure we know what we're talking about. We have to get informed. We have to know a few things. And one of the things I'm most pleased with in my life, I'm not going to say proud, but pleased with, is that I really am able to dialogue with both sides. I talk to people all the time, not just in D.C., but in other religions in the world, who respond to the fact that I basically fundamentally respect them, see them as creatures made in the image of God, even though I'm very open about the fact that I don't agree with their faith. I was in the Middle East not long ago and sat with a mullah for the better part of a day. We laughed and talked very clearly about how we disagreed. Well, you know, what he responded to was that I knew a little bit. He liked talking to an American he thought was, you know, decently read. And then that I showed him basic respect rather than talking to him like he was the king of terrorists. And, you know, you can imagine not only the open doors that I had to maybe do good for the country and as an American, but also I shared very vocally with him and very firmly with him my Christianity. So I think that same approach when it comes to dealing with the public square, dealing with politics, be informed. Don't be angry. As one of my Pentecostal friends says, have a good spirit on you, and be eager for truth to come to the surface rather than just to press a point. And when we approach it that way and ask meaningful questions, especially sort of asking them to draw the line, like I said earlier, I think we'll not only find a helpful dialogue, but we'll find meaningful answers.
A lot of counselors often say that anger is a secondary emotion to fear, hurt, or anger. I mean, fear, hurt, or frustration, forgive me. And so you think about so much of that anger behind it is frustration, it's fear. And I feel like for you, Stephen, to know that God is on his throne and you've educated yourself on the issues so you can talk comfortably knowing I don't have to fix all of this in one conversation. And I think there's such a fear that's fueling the angst, which is coming out in anger. We've got to settle some of those things if we want to be taken seriously, don't we?
We do. We do. And I think there's an element of being just genuine. I mean, when I'm talking to, let's just say that I'm talking to a politician with whom I completely disagree. Well, I've got to begin with the understanding that Jesus died for this person, that they are made in the image of God, that maybe they've chosen the things they believe that I don't agree with because they think they are the truth. Those things are the truth in their mind. It's not just that they went out and decided to be deceived. So maybe if I start just with a little compassion, little gentleness, while not compromising on the truth, I'll make more progress in every way, whether it's getting answers to my questions or trying to influence them for righteousness. Having that kind of basic sense of this person's value, rather than just treating them like, you know, idiots who are in the way of God's will in the world, I think you find people responding, and that's been an approach I've tried to practice, and it's why I can, you know, talk to Rachel Maddow on the air one night and John Hannity the next, and have pretty fascinating conversations and maybe some really intriguing behind off camera conversations. It's because I start with the assumption that, you know, I don't agree with much that Rachel Maddow says, but Jesus died for her, and she's pursuing truth as she understands it. Let's start there.
So good. When you say that there are three certainties about religion and politics, I'd love for you to unpack these if you don't mind. The first one, there's beauty to a life informed by faith that is inspiring to behold. That's beautifully written, by the way. What do you
say?
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are Hindus running for office, in office right now. There's a Muslim in the Congress. I've spent time with people like that. And a person who is trying to find or seek God is a person who is, you know, quite frankly, even if they're on the wrong path from a Christian perspective, there's a beauty to it because that's what they're made for. They're responding to the eternity in their hearts, Ecclesiastes 3. They're hungering to fill that hole in their soul that St. Augustine talked about. There's beauty to that. So I start there. And having spoken to many, many, many Muslims in the Middle East, for example, I often say, you know, I join you in seeking the truth of the living God. And many times they'll burst into applause, you know, because I'm just affirming that we are all attempting to find the living God. Starting there takes us a long way, and also celebrating the beauty of it helps a lot.
Excellent. There is an ignorance of religion in our generation that has become a threat of its own.
Yeah, just the fact that we don't know as much about religion as we ought to. You know, after 9/11, as I say in the book, a number of Sikhs who are, Sikhism is almost probably best understood as a break off from Hinduism centuries ago. A number of Sikhs, because they wear turbans and have beards, were killed, murdered, because people thought they were Muslims who were. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. In Texas and California, people thought that they were followers of Osama bin Laden, two completely different religions. In New York, there were rocks thrown through the windows of a synagogue, which, by the way, is a Jewish institution that is, you know, that Osama bin Laden would be unhappy with. I mean, the confusion was horrible. And these are just overt symbols, kind of newspaper symbols of why we're so confused. When you ratchet that up to our foreign policy and other things, it really does become a disaster.
Okay, third point. There is inherent connection between faith and public policy, between belief and governing.
Yeah, this is a rather silly debate that we've had sometimes in our society. When a person believes things religiously, when they believe things as a result of their religion, it will affect their politics. Politics is all about what's right, what's true, what's fair. Well, those are religious questions. Why don't we have laws that everybody has to wear blue shirts on Tuesdays? Because it's not a moral or ethical issue. It has nothing to do with justice or fairness or truth. But we do have laws about preserving human life and how the driver, because he has greater power, has to defer to the pedestrian. These are all moral and ethical issues. And so there's just no question. Religion will shape politics. We don't need to debate it. It's simply a reality like gravity. What we need to do is understand it better.
Talking to Stephen Mansfield today, title of his book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidate. All right, I've got a couple copies I want to get into your hands. Here's my email, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put Ask the Question in your subject line. Give me your mailing address. A couple of you will win a copy of this great book. We'll finish up with Stephen after the break. Having a great day today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to our friend Stephen Mansfield. Always love my conversations with him. Title of his new book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. And he writes, the role of religion in American politics should be the subject of careful analysis and reasoned debate, not just the stuff of cable news scream fests, as it is often today. Religion is not going away. It's shaping our world. We may not like it. We may not understand it. Yet, it rules us all the same. Better that we awaken from our dreams of a secular world to contend with the world as it truly is. You know, you've got a chapter titled Test of the Fathers, where you talk about a moment in history on June 28, 1787. Would you mind telling us that amazing story?
Absolutely. During the constitutional debates and deliberations in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin stood up and said, basically, gentlemen, we have been helped by God in our revolution. He has done miracles time and again. We can't assume that this deadlocked convention, these debates that aren't going anywhere about the Constitution, will ever be resolved if we don't turn to God. I suggest that we have prayer and meet for prayer regularly and so on. And it's a great moment and a beautiful speech. The fact is that the convention didn't act on it at all. Part of it was they were suspicious of any kind of religious service or what Mr. Franklin might have been up to. You know, he was quite the political operative. And the other part is that there already were church services and religious services that many of the convention attenders and delegates were attending. But it was a big moment in our country's history, because it really did show that the founding fathers acknowledged God and they saw that His miracle working hand, so to speak, had really given birth to the nation.
Well, they also feared, didn't they, just legislating religion. They wanted freedom, right?
The founding fathers absolutely wanted the states to be as religious as they wanted to be, and of course the individuals to be as citizens to be as religious as they wanted to be. What they wanted to do was keep religion out of the federal government in the sense of any institution. They didn't want any national church. So when Franklin recommended this, many of them said, "Ooh, let's let everybody go to church on their own and not do any religious thing as part of the convention." And it just shows some of the concerns they had. But remember, our revolution had been fought against an England that had a state church, and that state church had been forced upon the colonists. So they were very sensitive, maybe even more than we are today, to those issues.
So here's a tough question, not for you, though, but do you think it's possible from your perspective for a non-believing president to be a wise and moral leader for our nation?
I do believe that it's possible for morals and ethics to be held by somebody who is an atheist, but I don't think they have the power to live out the highest ethics and morals known to man, which, of course, is, I think, the teachings of Jesus, without the power of God, without the power of the Holy Spirit, and the power of a changed heart that comes through conversion. So can an atheist have morals and ethics that maybe are borrowed from some religious system or that they've evolved on their own? Yes, but I don't think they have the power, number one. And number two, I don't think they have the highest system of ethics as defined by God in their life unless they acknowledge God and are converted by the power of His Spirit.
I thought it was so interesting how you explored Mitt Romney's rise to, you know, vocational political success. And really, it was the conversation around religion that actually hurt him. Give us just a context of his story. Maybe tell us some things we did not know behind the scenes.
Well, Mr. Romney is a lifetime Mormon and was, as close to, well, he actually was the only kind of clergy that Mormons have. So it was really like he was a Baptist pastor in a sense, but for Mormons, had been very successful and so on. And what we knew from the statistics was that many Americans were suspicious of Mormons, and about 40% of the evangelical base in the Republican Party said they wouldn't vote for a Mormon. They thought Mormonism was a cult. So I certainly wasn't desiring to advocate for Mormonism, but I was asked back at that time by some of the people in his campaign, and I did write publicly, that Mr. Romney should air out his Mormonism. He should discuss it. He should be open about it. He shouldn't be angry about discussing it. I mean, after all, Mormonism had some unusual features about blacks and women and some others that affected public policy. So again, while I didn't want to invade Mr. Romney's family or his private space religiously, I did think he ought to air it out. Well, when he did his convention acceptance speech, I titled that chapter "The Three Words" because he only mentioned Mormonism in three words. "We were Mormon." That's all he said. And he got angry in interviews whenever anybody asked him about his Mormonism. And after he had lost the election, Netflix did a documentary on him. And on camera, Mr. Romney is heard to be saying, "Everybody just thinks I'm a Mormon flip-flopper, just a Mormon flip-flopper." Well, what's the answer for a politician who's running for office and has something? You've got to air it out. You've got to get there before anybody else does. You've got to hang a lantern on it and discuss it and sort of pierce the balloon of pressure that's gaining around it. And he just wouldn't do it. And there's no question that it hurt him in that election.
In fact, you wrote a speech that would have been what you would have done if you could have advised him. Can you give a little bit of advice, you know, just as if we're having this conversation, what you would have suggested that he say to shine a light on this?
Sure. I thought that it would have been very engaging of Mr. Romney to say, "Look, I am Mormon because this has defined my connection to God. It's what my people have been for a generation or two. But I'm not intending to force that on the American people. And by the way, this is a persecuted faith. I know something of what it's like to be persecuted for your faith. I know the value of your faith as you live it in the face of opposition. I want to encourage all Americans to live out their faith. I will never impose my Mormonism on anyone. And so please send me to Washington and let me help to lead a nation that lives the highest value of American religious liberty. Now, something like that, I'm not quoting my exact text, but something like that, I think people would have stood up and applauded, and I think people would have loved that a Mormon didn't seem that hidden and nervous about just airing out parts of his faith. I mean, the only religion in America to ever be under an extermination order, official extermination order, Mormonism. So Mr. Romney could have talked about his Mormon faith and probably won people over, not to the faith, but to the fact that he was not just a rich guy living in rarefied air and believing this unusual religion. I think it could have been a positive for him, but he just couldn't bring himself to do it.
Well, I'm sure you heard a lot of the conversation around from Christians regarding him, because Mormonism isn't consistent with the Christian faith. And so some would say, I'm not going near this. I'm not voting for him. I'm a Christian. He's a Mormon. But others would say, yeah, but look, he's been honorable and successful as a husband and a father and a businessman. I mean, what advice would you give? How would you speak into that debate, Stephen?
I would say, look, we are living in a country where Christianity still is profoundly influential, but it's not the only religion shaping our public life. And I agree that Mormonism, I mean, I've even hurt the feelings of some of my Mormon friends by saying I don't believe that it's Christianity. But Mormonism does produce patriots. It does produce people who are strongly pro-family. It does, forbid. Mormons don't tend to drink alcohol. They don't even tend to drink caffeine. They stay off of drugs, stay off tobacco. They tend to be very prosperous because of their values. These are all commendable virtues. So when we don't have a choice in our politics between the ideal candidate, and another slightly less ideal candidate, we have to just simply choose among the virtues of systems we might not believe in. I'm not a Mormon, and I can't advocate Mormonism, but there are some fruits, there are some ethics, there are some values in Mormonism that help make men like Romney good political choices in this present society, and I think that we have to embrace that.
Okay, we've just got a moment here before we pray, Stephen, and I find myself, I'm praying a lot lately about our nation and about the church and about political leaders, and I keep finding myself praying, Lord, give us the leader that we need, not the one we deserve. I would love to know from you, Stephen, how are you praying as this political race shapes up?
I firmly believe in God's rulership over the earth and even politics. I'm saying that semi-humorously, even politics. And I ask that the Lord causes the truth to come out, exposes conspiracies, exposes lies, and causes a virtuous man or woman to stand clearly obvious so that the voters can rally to them. I want him to rule over this election and cause righteousness to win out. Let lies, conspiracies be exposed. And so that's how I pray. Mm. And I also, by the way, pray for future generations or future elections, that we have righteous men and women in the preparation process of God now. I think we need a better class of candidate, and that's not to be insulting of the people running now.
Wonder if you just consider putting yourself on that ballot, because I'd vote for you.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I'm not sure I'd be a good one. Again, being 10 feet tall and 900 pounds and too bluntly spoken, I'm not sure I'd get there, but still, I'm happy
disagree.
To play a role.
I disagree. This has been so great and just such a beautiful book. Would you pray for our nation, Stephen? Appreciate that so much.
Absolutely. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time, and we bring before you the age-old covenants in American history, the words of our founders who said they sailed for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, those who prayed, sought you, the revivals that happened, the outpourings of the Spirit. We ask you to look upon all of that and remember your purposes for this land. Lord, expose lies, expose conspiracies. Let righteousness arise. Let your pulpits be aflame with righteousness, and let righteousness arise even in our politics, that your purposes might be accomplished now. Give us courage, give us faith, and break disillusionment off of our lives, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen.
I want to write that prayer that you just prayed in script, and I want to pray it every day. Really fantastic. I love what God's doing in and through you, Stephen. Thank you so much for the time today.
You're always encouraging. Thank you so much.
God bless you, sir. Title of the book again, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates.
You hold my faith up. You remind me who I am. You hold my faith up. I'm alive in you again. I'm made new. I'm made new.
What if we all pray that way, that lies and conspiracies would be exposed, that righteousness would rule and reign, that God is sovereign and raise up your person? What if we all prayed that way? Let's do that, okay? You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program on our website at myfaithradio.com. And if you'll be traveling in the near future, you can get our free Faith Radio app and take us with you wherever you go. God bless you. We'll meet you back here next time.